Hi everybody, it's Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain Radio. This is a debate that I had with Michael Badnarik, the 2004 Libertarian presidential candidate, in Philadelphia on Sunday, July 5th, 2009. I'm afraid there have been a few audio problems. The first few minutes are fairly low quality, but that does improve after that. Thank you for your patience as we have wrestled with the technical difficulties to stitch this Frankenfile together, and thank you so much to Paul, the expert sound engineer whose gentle spectrographic caresses have resurrected this file to a fairly high level of quality, and thank you so much for your patience, and to the organizers of the event at Drexel University, and I hope that you enjoy the debate. This is Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain Radio and Michael Badnarik, constitutional scholar, debating the proposition or the question, how much government is necessary?
I want to welcome everybody today, and I want to especially thank you for being here. I have been trying to light the fires of liberty for many years, and the good news is that I see things turning around and moving in the liberty direction. And I want to thank you especially for being here. I mean, when there shows this much public interest in an abstract and highly intellectual debate like anarchy versus anarchy, it's like, wow. I mean, they're not like watching Jerry Springer. They're actually here today. This is very good news. And again, I want to thank you for your participation. In any discussion or debate, obviously we need to define terms. And I'm sure that Stefan and I will be enhancing those definitions as we go along. As a start, I would like to offer that anarchy basically is an absence of government, 0%, as opposed to perhaps a totalitarian dictatorship would be 100% government. And so somewhere in the middle, I would like to propose that minarchy is at the low end, maybe 5-10%, I'm not quite sure exactly what that percentage would be, and that currently, today, we exist with 95%, I mean, I don't think we are complete totalitarian dictatorship, but you know, I think that might be argued we're moving in that direction. Well, anarchy and minarchy are very, very close to each other, and most of you are familiar with what we currently have, which is, you know, a plethora of government, far more than we need. And so from the existing point of view, looking back down the scale towards 0 and 5%, anarchy and minarchy are going to look and appear to be very, very close to each other. And Stefan and I will try to do our best to differentiate the two of them. And as kind of a metaphor, I was a chemist, and as a high school chemist, one of the things I found interesting was distilling ethanol. I don't know if anybody else had that interest, but when you distill ethanol, alcohol, the maximum that you can get is 95.6% alcohol. That's the maximum. And we have 4.4% water, because you just can't distill any more water out of the alcohol. And, you know, so 191 proof is basically the maximum that you can get. We usually call it Everclear. And as far as I'm concerned, anarchy is that theoretical absolute that we are always trying for, and we can try to distill as much of the government out of it as possible, but we'll always have just a little bit of government. And this is an issue that the Founding Fathers certainly addressed. I consider myself the stepfather of the Constitution. James Madison was the father of the Constitution. He died in 1836. Since then, the Constitution has been pretty much abandoned and orphaned. And so I've adopted the Constitution and will protect it as if it were my very own. So the father of the Constitution, James Madison, wrote, "It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government, we which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. The dependence on the people is, no doubt, the primary control on the government. But experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. So, as much as I would like to have anarchy, I don't think that we can actually achieve it, because there are some things that are necessary for anarchy to exist. And one would be widespread intelligence and adherence to a high ethical standard, one that I tried to achieve myself. In the 50s and 60s, we have stories legion about people leaving their doors unlocked, you know, leaving the keys in the car because neighbors were dependent on each other, and you just never expect anybody to walk into your home or take your car. Today, you know, we have people putting bars on their windows and locking everything, and even your laptop has to have a key on it these days. Another thing that anarchy requires is self-sufficiency and, you know, dependence on yourself. Currently, less than 10% of the families in the United States live on farms and can't produce their own food. The general population is completely oblivious as to where their utilities come from. I was in a gas station, getting ready to pay for the gas, and we had a blackout. Suddenly, everything went dark, and a woman came rushing in and said, "I can't pump any gas." And I informed her that they're in a blackout. And she goes, "But I have cash." And I said, "That had anything to do with it." Being completely and totally self-sufficient may be possible, but it means that your standard of living is lower.
Because now you have to be responsible for everything. You have to, you know, do your shelter, your own protection, growing your own food, and your entire life becomes devoted to, you know, keeping yourself alive. And so, I mean, even if we have, you know, people arrive in a deserted island, and the first thing that they do is they start to cooperate. You go find firewood, I'll build a hut, you know, you go look for fish, and you have this cooperation, mutual cooperation that will improve everybody's standard of living. You know, you go catch the fish and we can cook the fish over the fire that I build. The question, I suppose, really amounts to, does mutual cooperation, you know, equal government? How formalized does that cooperation have to be before we give it the label of cooperation? And finally, in order to have anarchy, we have to have mutual trust in each other. And again, it may be just human nature, but I don't believe that we do have trust in each other. Most of the laws that are created by our neighbors to control us and by us to control our neighbors. The general idea is that, well, of course, I can carry a gun because I'm adult and responsible, but I'm worried about my next door neighbor. I want the government to have, you know, concealed carry permits to moderate my neighbor's behavior because I don't trust my neighbor. And the end result is that the government creates a law for me against my neighbor, creates a law for my neighbor against me, and, you know, we keep creating more and more laws against each other, and we all basically lose. So we all struggle to stay alive, knowing that eventually we're going to lose that struggle and we will all eventually perish. But that doesn't stop us from struggling to prolong our lives. Liberty is something we should always continually strive for, knowing that even if we were lucky enough to achieve it, we'd almost certainly start to lose it immediately. And anarchy, I would, you know, equate to a utopia. Yes, I am definitely trying to move away from the massive government that we have to far, far less government, in the direction of anarchy. But given human nature, I'm not quite sure that we can achieve it. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the chance to speak, and thank you for this very kind introduction. I will be speaking about a different kind of anarchy than Mr. Badnarik is speaking about, which seems to be similar to the Stone Age. I don't think that you need self-sufficiency to be an anarchist. I can't find anything in the fridge without my wife pointing it out, so I think that we'll be talking about a little bit of a different kind of anarchy. I am what would be technically known as an anarcho-capitalist, in that I try to profit from anarchy. That's not it. It's that I believe in what I think everybody here would believe in, which is property rights are absolute, self-ownership and property rights are absolute, and the non-initiation of force is a moral absolute. And I'm sure that most libertarians, most minarchists would agree that property rights are double plus good and that the initiation of the use of force is very bad. The question or the difference or the divergence between an anarchist and a minarchist, I think, would be along these lines. That an anarchist looks at the principle of property rights and the non-initiation of the use of force and says those principles are inviolable. We are not willing to take those principles over our knee, bend them backwards until they break in order to achieve some pragmatic objective. The minarchist, in general, will say, yes, it would be great to have a utopia where everybody was perfect, and they believe that anarchists do not recognize the reality of human corruption and human evil. And I would say the exact opposite is true. I believe that an anarchist understands the reality of evil, the potential for evil in the human psyche. And it is because an anarchist recognizes the reality of evil that we oppose the creation of a monopoly of legal violence within society. It's like certain people have a propensity for addiction to alcohol or to drugs or whatever. And an anarchist who recognizes that metaphorically says, well, we're not going to put a distillery in their living room because they're drunkards or they're alcoholics. And human beings, many human beings, love to maximize their resources at the expense of others. It's a mere net gain calculation. What can I do in my life that's going to gain me the most resources in an amoral situation? Most people are biological creatures. That's what we do. We maximize resources. And the government is a terrible, powerful, ugly, and violent tool to maximize your resources at the expense of others. And since that's what human beings like to do, we can't have one. Power corrupts. Human beings like to get things for free. Human beings like to have power over other human beings. We are a tribal society. Darwinian evolution is why we're here today, which is gaining power over others and gaining things with the least amount of effort. Because human beings have that tendency, and the anarchist recognizes that, we cannot have a government, because that will immediately be inhabited by immoral people who will use it to their advantage and at the expense of the majority. It is my view that minarchism is a very dangerous philosophy, and not because I don't want less government. Of course I do. I want less government at the point of nothing, in the same way that I don't if I'm sick. I don't want less sickness. I want no sickness. That's my goal. But I think that minarchism is a very dangerous philosophy, and I'll tell you why. Either the minarchist is going to succeed or the minarchist is going to fail. If the minarchist fails, then the philosophy means nothing and the government continues to grow, which you could say is what's been happening for the past, say, 10,000 years. But if minarchists succeed, and I believe that they did succeed in 1776, I don't think that you could come up with a better laboratory experiment for the success or failure of minarchism than the creation of the American Republic. It was a beautiful theoretical laboratory proof of the possibility and practicality of minarchism. And what has happened since then, we are all aware of, and that's why we're here, is we went from the very smallest government, which was about, what, 1%, 2% of what it is, we went from the very smallest government in 1776 to the very largest, most powerful, most terrible, most destructive government the world has ever seen. A government with the power to destroy the world many times over. First time in history that's happened. Never had a government that big and powerful before. Is there a relationship between a small government at the beginning and a big government at the end? I would say that there is. Because a small government that respects, to a large degree, property rights and opposes the initiation of force creates what? It creates a free market. Once you have a free market, you get staggering explosions in wealth. Right? Once you get in a society a staggering explosion of wealth, more money is available for taxation. More money is available for the military. More money is available for the endless hordes of social programs and social engineering that bureaucrats and politicians and statists love to do. When you get the smallest possible government, you create a free market which builds wealth, which builds power, which then government swells to take over. It becomes a gold mine for those who want power over others. If a man makes $100 a year and you tax him at 50%, he will revolt because he can't live on $50 a year. But if a man makes $100,000 a year and you tax him at 50%, he won't rebel. Which is why we're here and not in the streets, because we can survive on what's left over, because there's so much wealth in society. So when you start with a very small government, you create the conditions for a massive explosion in wealth that creates the greatest prize that politicians can get a hold of, which is the productive energies and wealth of a free, prospering, industrious, free market society. That's why I think minarchism is so dangerous. Another way to look at it, if you don't mind me stepping into metaphor lands, and hopefully I won't get too much of it on my shoe, is a guy comes to a doctor, two doctors, there are two doctors in a room, Dr. Minarchist and Dr. Anarchist, and yes, that would be a great superhero villain, don't you think? And the guy comes in, he's got some honking tumor hanging off his side, right? And he says, Dr. Minarchist, can you help me with this tumor? Because it keeps growing, and I have to get it cut, and then I have to go into chemotherapy, and my hair all falls out, and it's just terrible what happens. And Dr. Minarchist says, well, I can cut it down. I can shave that thing down for you. 80% maybe I can get it down. And the guy's like, but that's happened 20 times before. I've got my tumor shrunk down 80%. It just grows back, and I get sicker, and I have to go to chemotherapy. So what can you do? He says, best I can do. He says, well, can't you just cut the tumor out completely? He's like, oh, my God, no. That's utopia. That's crazy. If I cut out your tumor, you're going to get spontaneous tattoos on your forehead, mohawks. You're going to be riding around motorcycles with Mel Gibson. It's going to be chaos and anarchy and dogs living with cats and all kinds of horrible things, right? Scare stories abound if I cut out your tumor completely. And he says, but if you cut it down, it's going to grow back, he says to Dr. Minarchist. Dr. Minarchist says, don't worry, I've got a plan. What's your plan? Well, I'm going to cut your tumor down by 80%, but when I'm in there, I'm going to take out a magic marker, magic being the operative word, I'll lean over, and I'm going to write on that tumor, don't grow. And I'm going to call it a constitution. Because we all know that tumors respect constitutions, right? And then it just grows back. Now he goes to Dr. Anarchist, and Dr. Anarchist says, out it comes. It's a tumor. It's always going to regrow. It's happened hundreds of times in the past. It's going to happen again. So we're not going to compromise. We're going to cut it out because I know it's going to regrow. And that is the way that minarchism looks to an anarchist. It is a tumor. There are about 230-odd countries in the world today. Not one of them has a government that is not growing or has not grown considerably since it was designed expressly to stay small. There have been hundreds and hundreds more throughout history, from the ancient Egyptians to the ancient Romans, the ancient Greeks. The Magna Carta, look at that. We've got, it was actually more rights to the nobles, and you ended up with feudalism for another 500 years. Every single culture, every single country has designed a government to serve the people and to be small, to protect property, to oppose violence, and every single time, and we have 500 to 600 examples of this, it never once has worked. Because it breaks principle. We say we oppose violations of property and personhood, and in order to achieve that, We are going to create an agency endowed with the special, unique, monopolistic ability to violate persons and property. You cannot protect persons and property by creating an agency with the monopolistic power to violate persons and property. We all understand that when a parent leans over to a child and says, "Don't hit your sister," that that's a contradiction. It's the same thing. You cannot create an agency with a monopoly of violence to oppose violence. It never works. It tracks the principle right up front. And I think the very, very important thing that I would suggest is that one of the most important virtues in the pursuit of wisdom and knowledge is humility. I fully accept that the founding fathers were stone geniuses whose intellect we can all hope to maybe someday emulate in some small manner. And they genuinely were the cream of the crop of the Enlightenment, some of the most brilliant men of the age, well-versed in history, in philosophy, in political science. And they did some amazing work to come up with the best conceivable balance and powers and ways to keep the government small, separation of church and state. Brilliant. And it's been tried many other times. The British Revolution of the 18th century was supposed to keep their government small, right? Serving the people. What happened? It grew, just as the American Empire did, into the British Empire, which ruled a third of the globe, subjugated hundreds of millions of people. You make the government small, it grows. The smaller the tumor starts, the larger and more quickly it grows. And humility is very important. I do not believe for one split second that I have any kind of capacity to create scribbles on a piece of paper that is going to stop evil forever. Doesn't work. It can never work. How many of you would get a copy of a law written on a piece of paper, walking down an alley, some guy comes running at you with a knife, you're like, "Stop!" What's he going to do? It doesn't work. Because the Constitution, laws, they do nothing, they're pieces of paper. Say, "But the Constitution restricts the government." No, the Constitution brings down a tree or two, uses up some ink. Right? Nobody goes into a shooting match saying, "Look, I'm invulnerable." Right? It's just a piece of paper. It's not the solution to the problem of violence. And I do not imagine for a moment that I'm going to be smarter than the 500,000 geniuses who've tried to solve the problem of violence in society by creating a monopoly of violence. You could give me 1,000 years and 1,000 helpers to try and come up with magic spells, magic words on a piece of paper that would stop violent people forever from doing wrong with institutionalized violence. I would never be able to do it. That's called humility. Can't be done. Recognizing what is impossible is the first step to wisdom. And the last thing that I would say, what's my time? 1 minute? The last thing that I would say, which I would say very quickly, the last thing that I would say is that the belief is, in constitutionality, in republicanism, limited government, is that if you get the right words on a piece of paper, that evil people will no longer do evil, right? And they will come into government, they will go, "Oh, all right, no evil. Okay, no evil." But if we can come up with magic words on a piece of paper that will stop evil people from doing evil, we don't need a government, because we go to the mafia and we say, "Look, here's a piece of paper. It says don't do evil." They go, "Oh, okay, I'll stop doing evil." Or we go to a murderer and we say, "Okay, you did kill, but sign this piece of paper which says don't do evil." And you go, "Okay, I go free if I sign that piece of paper." "Okay, there you go." And we all understand that that will not stop the murderer and it will not stop the thief from doing evil. The pieces of paper will not stop evil people from doing evil things. If we can come up with such magic paper, such Harry Potter wonders, we get everyone in society to sign it and there'll be no more evil. We don't need a government. But we all understand that that's not how the world works, that evil people will find anything you want in order to get away with it. And that's what will happen in any minarchistic constitutionalist society. If we can do something wonderful with a piece of paper that will stop evil permanently in its tracks, we get everyone in society to sign it, lo and behold, there's no evil, we don't need a government. But if we doubt that that will work, then how is it going to work with politicians? If it's not going to work with the mafia, how is it going to work with an even more organized set of criminals called politicians? We understand we don't stop the mafia in its tracks by getting them to sign a piece of paper with rules on it. If it's not going to work with the mafia, it's not going to work with the murderer, it is not going to work with politicians. And recognizing that basic reality is where the creativity of coming up with a stateless society, with how a society works in the absence of government, is all about. I don't like... Yeah, you've seen this cartoon. I won't say you've seen this cartoon that, you know, someone's got this equation right up here on the board, right? And then he comes up with an answer, and there's a cloud in the middle called, then a miracle occurs. And somehow it comes to the answer here. And there's some guy who comes up and says, you might want to flesh that bit out a little, because I'm not too clear on that. Well, to me, it's like, well, we want a nonviolent society or a society that opposes violence and supports property rights. And to me, the Constitution and minarchism is like, then a miracle occurs, and boom, we get, you know, this free, wonderful society. That part doesn't work, and so we need to find another solution. And of course, my podcasts and my books, if you're interested, they're all free. You can look into that. There's lots of creative solutions about how we can have roads, national defense, police, law courts, all the things that we need because there are bad people in society. There's lots of ways to do it that don't involve this magical golden gun that's going to make everyone good and is never going to attract bad people to try and control it. And I think that's where we need to spend our creative energies rather than the fantasy that pieces of paper will stop bullets. Thank you.
So, just get this out of the way now at the beginning. City would build the roads most efficiently, or any public good for that matter. And Mr. Bednar, if you'd like to take the question.
John, hello. I don't understand which society would build the roads. Well, I figure it'd be pretty much the same. There's no reason. I mean, having a minarchist, you know, small government implies that there are a lot of things the government doesn't do. And so I think it'd be pretty much the same if you don't allow the government to build the roads in a minarchist environment. It would turn out to be the same way in an anarchist, you know. I mean, it both ways, it could be private. And as I tried to explain or express at the beginning, our current point of view, you know, from where we sit now with government, minarchy and anarchy are going to be like almost identical, and it's going to be up to Stefan and I to really kind of distinguish how they are different.
You all ready for a bad pun? Like a question of the roads. I consider myself a bit of a roads scholar. Anyone? Hello, is this thing on? Hello. Take a moment to enjoy that joke, shall we? Well, I mean, it's funny, you know, the environmentalists who have a lot of good things to say are strangely addicted to avoiding this topic of the fact that the taxes paid for roads is one of the worst things for the environment, right? Because people don't have to pay for their driving in that sense, right? I mean, yeah, they pay some gas taxes, but you wouldn't be able to drive if the government hadn't built all the roads. Roads are pretty simple, right? I mean, they existed prior to the government. It wasn't like there were no roads before the government. There were private tolls even in the 18th century in America, which all worked fine until the government took them over. If you want to go build a housing development, you're never going to sell the houses unless there's a road to it. And so roads are pretty easy to solve. And even if you don't accept the technology now, which can actually track where people drive and send them a bill. I mean, there's when I used to have a real job, I went on a highway that is entirely private. And I paid a toll, and it was beautiful. I mean, it was like an airport landing strip. It was fantastic. Whereas, of course, the public highway was just, you know, stop and go, choked up, right? So... absolutely, roads will be much, much better, much more efficient, and those roads which are not supported by the traffic will fall into disuse and there'll be changes. People will drive less or work at home more, and we will end up with a much more efficient use of resources without all this crazy government subsidies. And the fact, of course, that they don't charge you for peak usage is crazy. That way people all drive to work at 9 o'clock. It's, you know, nuts. So a much, much more efficient use of resources, and I think we would agree that that should be a private function, minarchy or not. So.
This next question is for Michael Bednar. Also remember that rebuttals are allowed after a lot of time. Michael, is individual freedom compatible with government no matter how small it is?
Is individual freedom compatible with?
Compatible with government no matter how small the government is.
Yes, it is compatible because we have individual rights. The basic premise of my book in my Constitution class are the difference between rights and privileges. We, the people, have unalienable individual rights. We don't have to ask for permission a privilege is something that someone allows you to do, and they can revoke that privilege at any time. And most of us are not really clear on the concept that we have individual rights. We give the government privileges. Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1 says, all legislative powers herein granted. Well, when we are granting legislative powers, it implies that they are privileges, and we can take those privileges away from the government anytime we are brave enough to do so. And my supporting evidence would be the Declaration of Independence, which says that when any form of government becomes destructive of your rights, the right of the people to alter or abolish it. I think we can all agree that it's time to alter the government. And, you know, again, we have the option if we want to abolish it and to establish a new, you know, to provide new guards for our future security.
I disagree. I think it's important to remember that the disparity of power between citizens and governments now is very different than it was in the 18th century. In the 18th century, we had muskets versus muskets, right? I mean, it was a relatively similarly armed opposing groups, right? What's that old Bill Cosby thing where they lose the coin toss, the British lose the coin toss, and it's like their handicap is that they all have to march in a row with big X's on them, and the revolutionary force can live in the woods, you know, dressed in tree branches and shoot from wherever they want. But back then, it was relatively equal, right? I mean, because there were no nuclear weapons, there were no spy satellites, there were no, I don't know, brain frying lasers from UFOs and stuff. The amount of hardware and technology that is available to a state to dominate its citizens now, not to mention computers, deduction of source of income tax, and so on, it's all nuts how much you can be tracked and controlled because of the technology that was largely developed in the free market, is what I was saying. Small government means free market. Free market means innovation. Government takes over that innovation and uses it to control citizenry. You are creating the weapons that are used to keep you down. And so in the future, not everyone's going to have a nuclear weapon, obviously, but the government will, because usually minarchists say government for national defense. How are you supposed to conceivably, no matter how many six shooters you have, how are you supposed to stand up to F-16s and M1 tanks and nuclear weapons and aircraft carriers and spy satellites? It's simply impossible. That's why you can't have a government now, because the disparity between the average citizen's strength of might and the state is simply far too great. The citizen can never control the government, and the government will always be that well armed, and that's why we have to get rid of it as an institution completely.
Okay.
Hand-to-hand combat. And that's, I think, where this is going to go in about 3 minutes. Conflict resolution, of course, is essential. I mean, the reality is people are going to disagree, people are going to cheat, people are going to steal, people are going to do bad things with good promises. And that's the reality, which is, of course, why we can't have a government, because those people will all swarm to the government while they have a monopoly of force. There's lots and lots of different ways of coming into it. Something that's really, really powerful in society is ostracism, right? It's a really, really powerful thing. I think Michael's completely right that interdependence is the key to wealth, division of labor. We're all so dependent on each other. I mean, if I had to grow my own food, I'd end up eating my feet. It would just be crazy, right? And I'm not that flexible, so I'd be really hungry. But we are so interconnected that if we are not allowed to participate in economic life, it is a complete catastrophe for us. And so I have this, it's a bunch of articles and podcasts, and there's a book called Practical Anarchy, which you may think is an oxymoron, but I don't, which is available for free on the website, which I have these dispute resolution organizations. I don't know how it's all going to work because I can't find the future down to the last detail. No one can, but it's a way it could work. If Michael and I enter into an agreement to do stuff together, right, he sells me an iPod, I'm going to give him $100, then we have insurance, right? And so 2% of that goes to the insurance. And then if he doesn't ship me the iPod, I get the $100 from the insurance company. And if I don't pay him and he ships me the iPod, he gets $100. If we trust each other, we don't have to have that. Then we have no recourse and so on. Anytime you sign a contract, we both nominate an objective third party who's going to mediate the disputes, and we agree to abide by that ruling. And if we don't abide by that ruling, we are no longer allowed to participate in contracts. These dispute resolution organizations simply won't allow us to continue in contracts until we deal with the problem. And then we face the problem of ostracism in a society where to be ostracized is to go to the Stone Age caricature of anarchy that Mr. Badnarik portrayed a little earlier. the interdependence of human beings means that we have an enormous amount of power and influence over each other without using violence, just by saying, I'm not going to do business with you if you break your contract. That is a disaster for people. And of course, right now, conflicts aren't resolved at all. Anyone here ever tried to use the court system to resolve a conflict? Anyone? How did that go? Was it a productive and quality use of your time? Was it efficient? Was it positive? Was it useful? Anyone? Echo. So right now, we have the worst of both worlds. We don't actually have an effective conflict resolution, but competition is banned. And if we can survive this, we can sure as heck survive it where competition flourishes in the productive resolution of disputes to the benefit of the just party. Oh, I'm done. When I sit, that's it.
I agree that if we have a contract dispute, we can go to arbitration. There's a saying that in Texas, he needed killing is a valid defense. Fortunately, that's not necessarily true, but that's what it all boils down to. I don't know why. I wish that it were not true, but in human nature, you get enough people together, you're always going to find somebody who is crazy or somebody who is evil. And that's what it really all boils down to. We're not worried about the 98% of the people just going to go around and mind their own business. You know, we're worried about the lunatics that are going out to hurt others. And it is a necessary fact of life that at times you need to use violence to quell the violence. You know, fight fire with fire. And the question ultimately revolves around, where's that going to happen? Now, if you want to do anarchy and have everybody resolve these violent things themselves, I mean, I'd be happy. Let me wear my shoulder holster, and I promise only to shoot the guilty people. And, you know, even my friends are going to go, oh, wow, you know, we don't want to let Bednarik do that. That'd be a little bit extreme. And so the purpose of having a government, a minarchy, is to have a dispassionate use of force. I am obviously emotionally involved in the thing, in whatever the issue is, and, you know, it's like, they're guilty, kill them. And, you know, the idea is that we go, whoa, Bednarik, we're going to, you know, calm this down, we're going to take it slow, we're going to have a jury of our peers, you know, evaluate this. And, you know, if we finally decide many years later that, you know, the person did, you know, commit murder, then we can, you know, do a lethal injection or electric chair or something like that. And so this is where there is no good answer. You know, I would really like to never have to kill anybody. You know, like, why can't we all just get along? I don't know. Because people are strange that way. And so I am content to have a very small government. Say, okay, we're going to use force to protect your property, because most people won't. You know, John Wayne in The Shootist said that, you know, most people will flinch or hesitate before they pull the trigger. He says, I won't. I went to front sight training, and you have all these guys out there dressed in camouflage with all the extra ammunition hanging around there looking like little junior Rambos. And I said, well, okay, you know, you look really impressive, but you're shooting at a paper target. I mean, do you really have the courage to pull the trigger and take another human life? And suddenly it got all real quiet because they realized that in most cases they don't. And certainly a vast majority of people won't do that. And they need to be protected. And, you know, they want an organization to do that, you know. There is no piece of paper which is going to be perfect. We were discussing this last night. How can we write the Constitution so that it's perfect? How can we write a piece of paper so that this won't happen in another 223 years? And the answer is, it's not possible. You know, the cost of liberty is eternal vigilance. It's up to us. And again, there's no good answer. Either I have to kill them, or we have to have a government do it. And we're going to keep bouncing back and forth between, you know, who's going to have that power. And ultimately, I know the government will not protect me efficiently, which is why I am a very strong Second Amendment supporter.
This question is for both. Hypothesize, what might the world look like if the U.S. Constitution had never been ratified? Would the number of deaths throughout the world be larger or smaller without the U.S. government? We'll start with Stefan first.
Okay, good. Nice theoretical question. Well, if the U.S. Constitution had never been ratified, there would, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that there would be little to no federal government. What that would mean is that the competition among the states to keep their productive citizens would be very high, right? Because originally there were 13 sovereign nations, right? Like not the EEC, but France and Germany and England, right? So what would have happened if the Constitution was not ratified is that there would be no federal government. There would be individual countries, and those countries would compete to have people stay and not move and not leave, because it's really hard to control the movement of people in the 18th century, right? I mean, there weren't even any passports until the First World War, because people would stow away, they'd come here, there was no, you know, electronic this, that, and the other. You could just go wherever you wanted for the most part. So there would be that aspect, and that competition to keep people would mean that taxes would be slower to rise, because the less centralized things are and the easier it is to move between things, the more competition there is, right? Because it's like a bunch of farmers, like where the cows can go wherever they want. You have to provide them some good grazing in order to, I don't know, slaughter them later in a tax metaphorical sense, right? But there would be greater competition. Oh, now I'm hungry. Oh, well, I'll eat later. There would be greater competition for the tax livestock, which I think would help things. There could have been a civil war that would have gone on, but it wouldn't nearly have been as bad, and I doubt it would have actually happened, because I think, as we all know, not having gone with the schoolhouse rock version of history, we know that the war was against the South in order to extract further tax concessions and had nothing to do with slavery. That would not have occurred. Slavery would have died out, as it did, because they just would have eventually figured out that slaves not only completely immoral, but economically unproductive. So slavery would have died out just as it did in the rest of the world, simply by governments no longer cashing slaves. That's all you have to do to get rid of slavery. You don't need a stupid civil war. As they did in Brazil, the government just said, okay, we're not going to cash your slaves anymore, and suddenly it became too expensive to run after your own slaves all the time. And so slavery just ends when the government stops enforcing it. So it would have died out relatively quickly, because you wouldn't have been able to compete with the slave-free societies who have much more agricultural productivity. You for sure wouldn't have had the First World War, because the American involvement in the First World War, which there's a very strong argument that the American involvement in the First World War led directly to the Second World War, when Americans sent over huge numbers of troops. It tipped the balance of power against Germany so much that Germany had to agree to the Treaty of Versailles. Otherwise, they were just fighting to a standstill, and they would have gone home, and there would have been no Treaty of Versailles. Because Germany agreed to the Treaty of Versailles, they had to pay off all their debts, which meant they printed money. Germany would originally have been paying up until the 1980s for the First World War if the treaty had been honored. Because they had to print so much money, they ended up with hyperinflation, which destroyed the middle class, radicalized the Germans, who then turned to Hitler for a salvation. There was hatred of the Jews, because the Jews were perceived as the international bankers driving the hyperinflation, and so that hatred escalated. And so if you didn't get a First World War without the federal government, it's very unlikely you would have had a Second World War. So I would say that the Constitution has, in a very obviously abstract and theoretical way, the blood of millions seeped into its parchment. And without that, the history of the world, I think, would have been a much more peaceful and benevolent place. That's not even to count the things like, do we really think that Delaware would have invaded Iraq on its own? Of course not. Of course not. You have to have the federal government. And the reason you have the federal government is because it has the tax livestock, which gives it the fiat currency power to fund wars through preying on future generations. Right, so you would not have had the wars in Iraq, you wouldn't have had Korea, you wouldn't have had Vietnam, you wouldn't have had all the proxy wars that have been fought around the world, you wouldn't have extraordinary renditions, you wouldn't have the torture camps of Guantanamo Bay, you wouldn't have Abu Ghraib. There would be an enormous amount of peace, because the more you give people the power, right? Well, what is the slogan of government? Free evil. That's what it is. You get to do evil, and other people get to pay in cash and in blood. And the more abstracted you are from those you rule, the more evil you can commit. And that's why, if you're going to have a tyranny, you want it right by your side, not overhead in the sky dominating everything. So I think it has had a seriously negative effect on world peace. Sorry, that's a real sprint through history, and I'm not going to say you're going to agree with everything, but that's certainly a perspective that I would take.
I love a really good debate, and so I'm going to agree with Stefan. You got to agree with the truth. And again, anarchy and minarchy are going to be very, very close. We're going to have to, search hard to find some of the differences. I teach a class on the Constitution, but the Constitution is far from perfect. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 1, allows slavery to exist until 1808. There are definitely problems with it. The colonies were trying to repay the Revolutionary War debt. The 13 colonies were printing money like it was going out of style, and with printing money, you get hyperinflation and the economy stops. And so the people in the colonies went, well, we really love freedom, but the economy sucks. We want you to go to Philadelphia and modify the Articles of Confederation. And that's not what they did. They went, they threw the articles in the trash, and they came up with a more perfect union, more perfect than the Articles of Confederation, presumably. And it established a more centralized government. Alexander Hamilton was a monarchist. He didn't like King George III, but he thought that King George Washington would be a really great idea. Fortunately, Washington, rejected the idea. Alexander Hamilton's followers were nationalists. They wanted one strong centralized government. He knew they wouldn't go for that, and so he labeled his team of supporters Federalists, which is a lie. And Thomas Jefferson's followers were Federalists. They wanted a loosely distributed or loosely organized government, but that label Federalist had already been taken, and Hamilton said, well, if we're Federalists and you're the opposite of us, you must be anti-Federalists, which makes it sound like, so basically what Hamilton did was switch the labels, good guys and bad guys, and you switch the labels in order to get the Constitution ratified. Not a surprise that our politicians lie to us. The surprise really is that, 200 some odd years later, when we talk about the strong centralized government in Washington, D.C., we don't call it a national government, which is what it is. We go, oh, that's a federal government. And, so Hamilton was such a good liar, we're still falling for the lie, two centuries later. So if we had stayed with the Articles of Confederation, the Articles required unanimous support, a unanimous vote of all the, existing states. And try to imagine 50 states, united together and getting a unanimous vote from 50 states. How big do you think the federal government would be? It would be a trivia question. Okay, for, four tickets to the, local concert, you've got to identify the city where the, the national government is. And go, oh, gosh, I used to know that. So we would be better off. We want to make the government small. It is up to us. It is up to us to make sure that it stays small. That's what eternal vigilance, is all about. You don't go out and cut the lawn and go, wow, I've really got a well-manicured lawn, and this is the last time this summer I'm going to have to cut the grass. You get a good rain and, your neighbors are going to be complaining because the grass is a foot tall. Government is the same way. Thomas Jefferson suggested that, we need a little revolution about every 20 years, to kind of trim back the government that is grown up. The problem is, it's like earthquakes in California. In California, we like earthquakes about every 6-12 months, because when you have earthquakes often, everything vibrates. You go, wow, did you feel that? That was pretty cool. And nothing bad happens. It's, after 5 or 10 years when you haven't had an earthquake and all that pressure has built up, now you get 6.2 on the Richter scale and, knock down buildings and roads. So I think that we're at that place politically. We haven't had, enough revolution in a while. And if we do, in fact, have one, we're going to be knocking down some buildings. Socialism? Short answer? No. Any questions? Most Americans imagine this huge political dichotomy between the Republicans and the Democrats. You know, you're either red or blue, and that is a false dichotomy. I mean, that, you know, the Democrats want to control your life, the Republicans want to control your life. I mean, what the heck is the difference? The real dichotomy is between individualism and collectivism. In any decision about your life, either you can make that decision or the government can make the decision for you. And anybody with half a brain pretty much just agrees that, you know, I'm smart enough to make my own decisions without the government helping me. So socialism and communism are inherently evil. As Stefan pointed out, you know, private property is very important. It's the number one answer in my Constitution class. You know, every question about the Constitution ultimately derives, you know, the answer is property. Communism has 10 planks, and the first plank is to abolish private property. You have no private property, you have no rights, and, you know, socialism is just communism's little sister. Socialism is the imperfect implementation of collectivist principles. Communism is presumably the perfect implementation of those principles, and I am opposed to collectivism. You know, I defend everybody's individual rights.
Yeah, if it's not roads, it's defense, right? And I agree with this, what you're saying. And it really is frustrating when you're a communicator about freedom and liberty and anti-war and anti-violence and anti-torture and anti the rape rooms of modern status prisons and so on. And people say, well, yes, there is the blood of millions and there is the enslavement of millions and there is the starvation of millions through statism. But, you know, we can't be free because people need to drive places. It's such a strange perspective that because we have problems with how we're going to defend a geographical area, we must all be slaves and sheep and tax livestock and herded around and indoctrinated in schools and dangled a few coins in our old age because these problems are so insoluble. But they're really not. I take national defense. This is something that comes up. Oh, if there's no government, there's no such thing as national defense. Two quick answers, and there's more in podcasts and in books if you're interested. First and foremost, national defense. And the weird thing about when you use violence to solve problems, you freeze those solutions in time. Think of public education, right? We all, most of us went to public schools, right? In 1870s, they were nationalized, right? They went from the free market to the state. In 1860, you had a classroom with a teacher who had a piece of chalk and a blackboard, right? 150 years later, with the internet, with virtual reality, with homeschooling, with pen tablets, with every kind of communications transformation that you could conceive of, and a few that you could never conceive of, what do we have? 150 years later, we have a blackboard, a piece of chalk, and a teacher, right? It freezes solutions in time. When you wrap them in violence, they freeze in time. The problem with statism, fundamentally, is that it is a solution that is as old as humankind. It is fundamentally tribalism on a national scale. So it's at least 10,000 years old. You look back at 5,000 years or 7,000 years to the ancient Egyptians. They had governments. They had law courts. They had national defense. They had taxation. They had inflation. They had fiat currency. All of the staggeringly destructive shite that statism represents. We don't use medical technology from the ancient Egyptians. We don't use papyrus from the ancient Egyptians. But still we're supposed to use this concept called the government, which is so old. National defense has been superseded by technological advances. No country that owns even a single nuclear device has ever been invaded. Ever. Yeah, they fought proxy wars, right? England and Argentina in the Falklands. We've got Russia and America in Vietnam and Korea and so on. But no country that has a single nuclear weapon has ever been invaded. Why? Is Europe at peace for the first time in 10,000 years? Because they've got weapons of mass destruction. And the leaders, these brave political military leaders, suddenly seem to find a lot of restraint when they're in the crosshairs, right? When they can't just send young people to be slaughtered
but they themselves could get hit with a nuke suddenly. They seem to find a lot of restraints in the capacity for peace. So what do you need to defend a geographical area? A couple of nukes. What is that going to cost you? $100 million a year? It's a buck or two per person per year to guarantee that you're not going to be invaded. Any more, you're going to start causing trouble overseas, which gets people flying planes into your buildings. So you don't want any more than that. You want as minimum possible defense. It's completely easy in a free society. Second point, which I'll keep brief, is that, let's use our moderators here, just very briefly. All right, the guy in the suit is the statist society. We'll keep that theme running. And the guy without the suit, who should really be unshaven, is the anarchy society, right? So I'm evil third-party dude who has got a military and wants to invade, right? Why is it that I would want to invade another country? Is it to sightsee? Of course not. It's because I want to take over the tax structure of that society, right? Because that society has tax livestock which produce consistent money, which I can then spend, right? So if I go and invade this guy, then I can take over his tax structure, which is, of course, what every conqueror does, right? They go in, they take over the government, they continue to extract the taxes from the population. So I can go and invade this guy, this guy's country, I'll say, that's a little sinister otherwise. I go and invade this guy's country, and I can take over the tax structure of his state. But this crazy anarchy dude, right, his country, there's no tax structure. There's no tax collection. It's the difference between trying to take over a really well-organized farm that's very productive and wandering into a swamp. No disrespect. He actually smells great. I'm going back for just one more. But that's the real difference. If you have an anarchic society, there's nothing to invade because there's nothing to take over. There's no tax structure. There's no Fort Knox that you go and create. There's no national army. Right, why did Hitler go into Western Czechoslovakia? Because of the Skoda Armament Works, which were created by the state, so he could take those over. To get the 100,000 soldiers, to get the 20,000 tanks, to get the artillery unit, that's why he went there. If it was a stateless society, those things, those fruits, those benefits would not be there to take. So you don't have to, first, just a couple of nukes, and second, you don't have to worry about being invaded if you're an anarchistic society, because there's nothing to take. Not taking over a farm and getting the milk and the eggs, and they're just wandering into a forest where there's nothing to take. There's no one, no sane person is ever going to invade an anarchic society. Plus, of course, you don't know who's got what weapons, right? Which is a little different in a statist society. It's fun to invade a statist society, particularly in Europe, because the population is disarmed, right? Even the greatest military in the world is having a tough time standing up to Iraqis who are arming themselves, right? Because disarmament of Iraqis because they're just bringing arms in from outside. So you're simply not going to worry about national defense. It's going to be a couple of bucks a year, and even that's going to fade away. No one's going to want to invade you because there's nothing to take, and they don't know who's armed. You're just not going to have to worry about it, but we still think in the same old way as when that kind of status solution seemed to be essential for everyone, but it's really not the case. Technology and events and weapons of mass destruction have overtaken that need.
Next question. This is for both speakers. Ayn Rand once wrote in Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, that anarchy as a political concept is a naive floating abstraction. As a society without an organized government would be at the mercy of the first criminal who came along and who would precipitate it into the chaos of gang warfare. Stefan and Michael, please argue for or against Ayn Rand's stance on the stateless society.
First of all, I wanted to just mention I'm a massive fan of Ayn Rand. I think she is a stone genius describing the ages. And without her, I probably would still be some muttering Canadian socialist. Right? Canadian anarchist, isn't it the weirdest thing? It's like the two words you'd never expect to hear together, you know, like Finnish entrepreneur or military intelligence or something like that, right? It's just weird. You're an anarchist. You must be from Bolivia. No, Mississauga. Anyway. So I have huge, huge respect for Ayn Rand. The two things that I disagree with her approach on ethics, though of course I agree with almost all of her conclusions. Not that that means anything. I don't disagree with anything. It just means that I do agree. So I have the hugest respect for the Rand. She's one of the greatest philosophers who ever lived. I think her stance on anarchy is irrational. I know she's going to come and haunt my dreams tonight in some fierce, smoky way, but But she says that this some gang is going to take over society. But what are the old question? What are they going to take over? What are they going to take over? There's no tax structure in place. There's not this constant money spigot coming out of the government control of the citizenry. And if, you know, if there is this incredible desire for domination over other human beings, how does the existence of government solve that problem? It's a huge plum prize for every evil person to grab a hold of to control other human beings. Because it's already in existence, it's already self-funding. The military, the weapons, the control, the police, the prisons, the prison guards, the truncheons, the court system, everything. The indoctrination system through the children, for the most part, although I know she wouldn't agree with that. It's already in place. You just have to step in and take the money. But in a free society, a truly free society with no state, the apparatus for control and profit simply do not exist. You can't just go around creating them. I have a whole section in this book about, say, some defense agency, right? You pay for some defense agency. Wouldn't they just become another government? And it's completely logically impossible, economically impossible. I won't go through the whole argument because I've got my guy here who's keeping me on time. But have a look at it. I mean, there's really, really strong arguments as to how. Of course, there is a danger of human domination. That's why we can't have a pre-existing structure that is expressly designed for human domination called the state. If that's not there, people will be bullies in their private lives, but they're not going to take over the whole society of hundreds of millions of people and take half their income at the point of a gun, because that gun simply won't be there, and you can't just snap your fingers and create it in a free society.
I also want to say that I am a huge fan of Ayn Rand. I think that logical thought is the only way to come to any reasonable conclusion. In an earlier metaphor, Stefan was talking about government as kind of this cancer, and he suggested that you don't go into the doctor and ask him to cut out 80% of the tumor. Obviously, you'd want to remove all of it. What that metaphor overlooks is that the tumor had to, you know, arise spontaneously the first time. And then we presume that it had to come from somewhere. And I believe that is true about government. Again, if we could eliminate, you know, all government. And again, we haven't actually defined what government is. I mean, I don't know if we've established that mutual cooperation with nothing written down is you know, anarchy. And then it's only when you write stuff down. But as soon as we start to have contracts, you know, we write contracts on paper because we presume the paper's not going to change. You know, if Stefan and I agree to something verbally, and we shake hands and we're really good friends, and we come back a year from now and I go, "You said," he goes, no, that's not what I said. If we don't have anything written down, you know, we can end up, you know, arm wrestling or getting into fisticuffs to try to debate what was done. We have it written down, we can go, "Oh, here it is on paper, that's, you know, that's what we agreed to." So, and even that is not a perfect cure, because, you know, those contracts can also be misinterpreted or reinterpreted later. But again, one of the factors that make anarchy, I mean, so wonderful but impossible, is human nature. Most of us, I'm going to just roughly estimate, you know, 98% of us just want to be left alone. You know, I really, really like you, but I have no desire to interfere in your life whatsoever. I mean, I'm busy trying to run my life, and I'm not doing that real well. So I don't have enough time to try to control yours. But for whatever reason, there are people in society who just think that they know how to run your life better than you do. You know, all you got to do is, and they're more than happy to spend their part of the day, you know, doing things to control you. And they can formalize it, you know, and put it in paper, and you've got government. And if you don't nip it in the bud there, it's going to grow bigger and bigger. And eventually, you will have a huge organized system of plunder that, you know, somebody else can come in and take over. At least you hope they can take over. If it's impervious, then we're in trouble, because we do have a very huge, powerful government right now that is euphemistically known as the United States. And if we, the people, you know, don't stand up, it's going to, it's already out of control. And it's easy to, for it to get more out of control. In my constitution classes, I ask my students, hypothetically, if Chinese people have a right to life. And the answer is obvious to me, but they have to think about it a while and go, well, yeah, they do have a right to life, but they don't have a constitution, they don't have a Bill of Rights, and they also don't have a government that respects their right to life. Not a piece of paper that gives you your rights, you know. And what would happen? They've got 1.5 billion Chinese people. That's 1,500 million compared to our 300 million here. What would happen if overnight 1.5 billion Chinese people just stood up and said, hey, enough is enough of this, you know, communist dictatorship. We're not going to do that anymore. Well, it would end. You know, we are in an ideological war. It is a war of ideas, and the socialists and the communists are currently winning. You know, they have most of us convinced that they're in charge and, you know, we need to follow orders. Why does communism work in China? Sadly, because 1.5 billion Chinese people think that's the way it's supposed to be. They accept it. They allow it to happen. The same argument can be used here in the United States. 300 million people allow this to happen. All we have to do is stand up tomorrow and go, freedom, enough is enough. And we will be able to take back this government and have a lot more liberty and a lot more freedom. Three questions. This is basically what I had been alluding to one or two questions ago. It's all about the unfortunate human condition that some people are evil. Violence is going to happen. And in many cases, the only way to stop that violence is with additional violence, force. I mean, if you can, you know, throw a tarp over somebody and subdue them without violence, all the better. But somebody, sadly, somebody is going to have to use force and or violence to stop the bad stuff from happening. And again, if you want to have anarchy, just let me know. I'll strap on my .45 and you guys don't have to worry about my property. I am willing to take care of myself. And anybody tries to take my property, I guarantee that I will not hesitate when I pull the trigger. Most of the people in the world, specifically most of the people in the United States, are not willing to do that. They are not willing to engage in violence. They are not willing to even use violence for self-defense, which is a concept that just boggles my mind. But that defense needs to happen. Most people want to subcontract that out. You know, they want someone else to, you know, take care of them. We want it done responsibly. And again, that's this theoretical minarchy, which, you know, always protects, uses force to protect your rights and never uses force to violate your rights. I don't know how we get there. You know, it's like flipping a coin and having it land edge on, but that is the goal. I think that Stefan and I will agree that what we have now is way too much government. You know, let's start cutting back on government, minimizing it, making it smaller and smaller and smaller. And when we get to the 5% minarchy mark, we can reanalyze it and think, well, maybe we can go that last 5% and get anarchy. I'm willing to, you know, to learn, but we're never going to get to anarchy if we don't get to minarchy first. It is our responsibility. It is your responsibility to take control of your government.
So, you know, 2% evil, we're just trying to figure out who in this room is. There are evil people in the world, as I said at the beginning, there's no question of that. I have never heard a satisfactory answer, because there isn't one, about how, if there are 2% of evil people, and the evil people want two things, they want money for free and they want domination and power over others, that is the exact definition of what a government does. So if there are only 2% of evil people in society, let's say that's true, where
are they going to want to be?
Are they going to want to be in the government? The government is a rocket-propelled boost to evil. It's like giving evil that nitro thing in the car movies, you know? It just allows evil to go that much faster. You can't keep evil people out of government. You can't do it. Everybody thinks that there's evil people in the world, so we need these shining, virtuous government people to protect us from the evil people. But I don't want power over others. I'm not that avaricious for money. I guess I do this crazy thing for a living. But I recognize that there are lots of people out there who are hungry for power over others, who are hungry for free money. You have a government. Government is a monopoly of individuals with the legal right to initiate force, frankly, at will, because constitutions stop nothing. In fact, constitutions are dangerous because you think that they will save you from evil people, right? If you believe the lies of evil people, you are at their mercy. Right? Chamberlain goes to Munich in 1938 and says from Hitler, look, he said he's not going to invade any more countries. Right? They believed him. And what happens? If you think that pieces of paper will control evil, you are setting yourself up to be dominated by the very evil people who are the only people who want to have that kind of power over you, and the government is a ready-made place for them to go where they have that dominant capacity. Of course, if there are no evil people in society, we don't need a government. If everyone's evil, no government is possible. If a majority of people are evil, then you can't have a democracy because they'll just vote in evil people, right? If a minority of people are evil, which I believe is the case, then you can't have a government because that's exactly where it will draw them like a black hole draws matter. That's exactly where they will go. So this problem, which is, do remember the question vaguely, the problem of who will watch the watchers has never been solved. And to me, saying how will arbitration and how will conflict resolution and so on be performed in a free society is like saying who will determine the value of a good? Well, the competition, optimization, and efficiency of the free market determines the price or the value of a good. No central planning can do it. How do we find the best, the most creative ways to solve problems without institutionalized violence, which leads to war, inflation, predation, and destruction? I don't have all the answers. Nobody does. But I know the answer is not institutionalized violence. I know that the creative intelligence of human beings, which has been forcibly restricted from solving these problems throughout history, we didn't have a state created from us. We inherit a state from the origins of the species, like we inherit superstition. We don't any longer say, I need rain, I'm going to do a rain dance, because we understand that I don't have rhythm. But we inherited a state from the primeval ignorance of the species, the same way that we used to think that the moon was made of cheese and the sun was made of ping pong balls or something, right? But we now understand that slowly and painfully we have gotten towards a more scientific and rational understanding of the world. We have to shed the superstition of statism, the fantasy that we can give a small group of people the power of monopolistic power of initiating violence and make the world a better place. It's a superstition that we inherited. Like slavery, we inherited slavery from the origins of the species, and we outgrew it. And we don't sit there and say, oh my God, slavery is about to come back, right? Because we all understand that it's immoral and it's not coming back. It's the same with statism. We inherited it from the origins of the species. It is a primitive, dumb, stupid, violent, and ugly way to solve human problems because it doesn't solve human problems. It just makes them worse. It rewards evil people at the expense of the virtuous. And I can't spend my life running around saying, is the government getting any bigger? What stand am I going to take today to make it smaller? I don't want a life of eternal vigilance against the growing power of evil. I want to remove the apparatus which feeds it, which is the monopoly of statism. The very fact is that people don't want to spend their whole life caged with a rabid tiger saying, what's it doing today? How am I going to make it smaller? How am I going to control it? No! Get the tiger out of the cage and live free! We don't have to circle around this thing called the state and try and control it and make sure it doesn't get any bigger, because we can't! It's never happened before. It will never happen in the future. We just get rid of the whole thing as a concept, because it is an erroneous concept. Calling people the government does not change their moral nature. Putting a guy in a uniform does not mean that it's moral for him to kill. Putting a guy in a funny hat doesn't mean that he can fly. Calling someone the government does not give them the moral right to initiate the use of force. It is a logical and moral error to talk about a government at all. And so who will solve it? Free individuals voluntarily, not those with the power of coercion.
Next question. Michael, should an individual be able to secede from the government without repercussion?
Oh, yeah, I certainly hope so. Secession is a topic that comes up frequently with, 27 states doing 10th Amendment, proclamations these days. And we were discussing the War of Northern Aggression last night. And there is a widespread misconception in the United States that only Texas has the right to secede. I don't know where that came from. Maybe because we're just really stubbornly independent in Texas. But anybody, any state has the right to secede. And again, in our conversation recently, somebody tried to suggest that the Civil War proves that states, cannot secede. And it's like, so you don't know or either believe in or respect the Declaration of Independence? Oh, well, yeah, that's my favorite document. Well, the Declaration of Independence was a secession document. We seceded from England. And basically the only difference is that presumably we won the American Revolution and, the southern states lost, the battle of, for southern independence. You can have an idea, and again, this is an ideological war, and sometimes you have to stand tall and defend your ideas, and you may or may not win those ideas. But yes, I do believe that philosophically an individual should, my parents are both alive, I love my parents, but at my age, I don't ask mom and dad for advice. I talk to them frequently, they don't try to tell me what to do. In fact, mom bemoans the fact that, Michael, you're just going to do whatever you want to do. Like, yeah, that's pretty much true. Stubbornly independent. So if I'm not going to allow my parents to make decisions about my life, why on earth would I allow a government to make decisions about my life? That's absolutely ludicrous. So, what we need is a lot more people standing up and being independent and, by whatever method you want to, declaring a secession from the federal government, and we just need to have enough of us to make it stick. If I go up against the federal government by myself, I may be very valiant and I may be very courageous, but I'm going to end up looking like a pepperoni pizza. We need to have a majority of people holding these same ideas and defending them. If Stefan and I are walking through the jungle, I'm guessing that Stefan and I both agree that cannibalism is bad. But if Stefan and I, encounter cannibals in the jungle, I don't think it would be a really good procedure for us to stand in a soapbox and go, well, guys, this cannibalism is really, really bad because we're going to be the first ones in the pot. So you need to have enough people, you have to have a good idea to start with, and you have to have enough people supporting your idea to be able to defend it and make it work. And, the Constitution, I think, is a really good idea, better than most, not perfect. But right now, in the United States, we don't have enough people defending it. And the government is, way out of control.
I haven't eaten enough today. Because when you start talking about cannibalism, I had this total Bugs Bunny moment. All I did is I looked over and I saw a drumstick in a suit, with the aromatic, stuff going up there. And, you see the fade in and fade out. Anyway, but enough about me. Should an individual be able to secede from the government? I think it's very important for us to be precise and accurate in our language. I'm on a libertarian list forum with Kinsella and Block and a couple other people, quite a number of other people, and we got into a very fierce debate and did a whole video on this, because they couldn't quite understand the concept. Because they're trained in economics and they're trained in political science, they're not trained in philosophy, right? And so it was a bit of an educational milestone, because they were saying the government this, the government that, the government the other. Should the government be able to do this? Should the government be able to do the other? And it's like, well, that's like asking, should unicorns be allowed to play soccer? And really, that is a very real way of looking at it, because there is no such thing as a government. It is a concept that does not exist, right? We all, we say, okay, there's a crowd here, right?
you all bought your invisible friends, which is great, but there's a crowd here, right? And if you all leave, there's no crowd. Now, you can't take a photograph of a family with nobody in the picture, because it's just a conceptual fact. It doesn't exist in reality. No such thing as the government. What there is stuff written on paper, some very well-oiled and quick-to-be-pulled guns. There are aircraft carriers, there are buildings, there are flags. Those things all exist. There is no such thing as the government. There are people with guns. There are prisons. There are people who fear for their lives if they cross that government or do not pay its extractions. But there's no such thing as the government. It doesn't exist. So, to me, saying, should I be able to secede from the government, is like, should I be able to walk out of Middle Earth? It's a meaningless question. Do I have the right to live free of others initiating violence against me? Absolutely. Of course. But do I have the right to secede for the government? It's a meaningless question, because it presumes that the government is a conceptual tag with any meaning whatsoever, when it's not. It's just a bunch of people with guns. That's all they are. No such thing as a country, right? There's earth, there's trees, there's air, but there's no such thing as a country. No such thing as a government. I can't secede from it because it doesn't exist. I do reject the right of other people to initiate violence against me. That includes the people who call themselves the government, but I can't secede from that which does not exist. As long as we continue to believe that it does exist, we think that we're obeying something other than people with guns, but that's really all it's about. It's just people with guns. There's no such thing, and I can't secede from that which does not exist.
Okay, so for the final question, the United States of America has been called an experiment. What would be the hypothesis and what would be your conclusion?
That's a good question. I like the way that's phrased. The experiment is self-government. For countless centuries, governments across the world were all controlled by a king, an emperor, some monarch. And I don't know how we got there, but everything was derived from the concept of the divine right of kings. You know, without going into a lot of detail, God comes down with his magic wand, smacks some guy in the head, and says, you're the king, you own everything. You have all the rights, and you can distribute privileges to your subjects. They owe you their life, they owe you, I mean, unless you can pick both feet up off the ground at the same time, you're standing on my land, and, you know, basically, I own you. And so we came to the North American continent and decided, you know, that's really not a really good way. And the Declaration of Independence establishes the idea that we are going to, you know, be blessed with rights, you know, ordained by our Creator. And so instead of, you know, God hitting the king in the head and we get privileges secondhand, now we are sovereign. We are kings and queens. And my book is entitled Good to be King, to express that idea. We have 300 million kings and queens in the United States. And we have rights. We can own property. We don't have to get our privileges from someone else. And this idea was so unusual, so unorthodox, so, what's the word I'm looking for? Revolutionary. That, you know, most of the countries around the world goes, oh my God, this isn't going to last. You know, 20 years tops. I mean, it's going to all fall apart. And so, okay, we've got 223 years. It hasn't been, you know, the best of times, but it certainly hasn't been the worst of times either. And by distributing the power, instead of having one person have that power, you know, life had been pretty good. The standard of living in the United States has exponentially increased. But we lost sight of the concept. You know, the concept is individual rights and personal responsibility. Everybody wants their rights. You watch the news and, you know, every other day you have somebody banging on the podium demanding their rights. Well, if everybody wants their rights, how come we're struggling? How come we don't have wall-to-wall liberty? Well, it's because nobody wants the responsibility. You know, you own your body. You're responsible for feeding yourself, you know, sheltering yourself. And, oh, by the way, you are responsible for providing for your own retirement. But our parents and grandparents were lied to. You know, the government says, we're bigger and smarter than you. You give us your Social Security money. And when you're ready to retire, you're going to have more money than you know what to do with. How many times have you heard the conversation, yep, Mom and I are going on vacation again. We just can't spend that Social Security money fast enough. Nobody on Social Security feels secure. And that's because we have given the responsibility of our retirement to the government, which is a really, really sad thing. So I think the experiment started out real well, but because we didn't understand that the cost of liberty is eternal vigilance, we didn't realize that, you know, the Founding Fathers didn't set it up to run in perpetual motion, that it's our job, our responsibility to provide for ourselves and to protect each other's rights and to keep the government small. And because we've allowed it, you know, we've allowed the tiger out of the cage, you know, now we are in trouble. We're trying to figure out how to get it back in the cage. So at this point, the experiment may be ready to go extinct, which I think is very sad.
I think that's the difference. You want to put the tiger back in the cage, I want some tiger skin pants. I think that everybody recognized, sorry about that image, everyone. Would you like to take a moment to put your lunch back? I think that every person who studies and thinks about these topics recognizes that America was, on paper, a noble step forward and a great experiment in attempting to create a government by and for the people to protect the rights of citizens. We create this government to secure our liberties. And I think that I certainly believe that it was a great and noble experiment. I can't imagine that the circumstances will be better. Maybe when we go and live on other worlds, you kind of need virgin territory to create a new society, because unfortunately there are so many people embedded in and dependent upon status largesse and handouts, from teachers to postal workers to retirees to welfare recipients to military industrial complexes to executives to banks to now car companies, you name it, that you simply can't pry that power out of people using politics. So maybe we could go to a new country, or sorry, a new planet, we can start something new, some new land mass arises, we can colonize it and start something new. But I think there was a really unique set of circumstances that gave rise to the possibility. It was a conjunction of new land mass, tyrannical governments in Europe and other places around the world that caused the best and the brightest to flee, as they always do. And you had the peak of the Enlightenment philosophy. You had the printing press, which allowed for the easy dissemination of amazing writings like Thomas Paine's and other writers, John Locke and all of these great philosophers. So you had an incredible alignment of the planets to create the greatest possibility for statism. And let's remember that the American Revolution was still a statist revolution. It was not, let's get rid of government for a small little bit that occurred, I think, in Pennsylvania, which Murray Rothbard writes about. But it was a statist experiment. I doubt ever there will be a better set of circumstances to test the theory of statism. But let's look at where it started and where it ended, because there is a bit of a myth. You know, did a lot of studying in history, and one of the things that you learn when you study history, especially at the graduate school level, is that the winners, sorry, I'm walking in front of you, the winners write the history. The victors write the history. Obviously, if Hitler had won, there would be a whole different set of history about the Second World War. And we do see the American Revolution and the American statist experiment through the lens of, you know, I hate to say it, but rich white landowners. They wrote the Constitution, they wrote the Declaration of Independence, they furthered the laws. I mean, there weren't a lot of black women who were on the federal court system in 1820. And we forget, by just looking at this small group of incredibly privileged and brilliant and I think, mostly honorable men, that there's a lot that's missing from our conception of how America started. I'll give you a small statistic. In the 16th century, the population, the native population of the Americas, North and South America, was estimated at about 24 million souls. By the late 18th century, it was about 2 million. Right? That is a greater than 90% reduction. Can we call it genocide? I think at some levels we can, because there were bounties put out by the federal government and the local governments that if you killed Indians, you got paid. It was the professional mafia hit jobs of the native population. Was some of it somewhat accidental, smallpox blankets? Well, yeah, you could argue that it is. But it did start on the whole, say, America rests on the graves of those who were here. And that aspect of things, it also started with slavery. I'll do 30 more seconds if that's all right. Started with slavery, and it started with certain aspects of a genocide. That's where it started. No rights for women, no rights for children. Slavery, genocide. Where did it end? The largest, most powerful, most brutal government, particularly overseas, that the world has ever seen, the most powerful and brutal empire. And I think we can do better. I don't think we have to stay within that paradigm that we start with genocide and end with empire. But there's another way. Say there's no good answer to the question of government. We need to start asking different questions, which is not what kind of government we have, but why do we need it at all? Now that we have the technology, the communications, the wisdom, the knowledge that we have now, we need to start asking smarter questions, not how do we tame the tiger, but why do we need the tiger? No government? No, I don't. I mean, I know I've been speechifying, and I'll not go on because I really do want to get to audience questions, but there's an old saying that if the powers that be can get you to ask the wrong questions, they don't care about the answers because you're just completely in the wrong ballpark. I do believe that there's two reasons why we do things, fundamentally. There's pragmatism and there's idealism. So pragmatism is like I need to mow my lawn, right, as you were saying. Right? I can either get a nice lawnmower or I can get some toenail cutters. Right? And if I use toenail cutters to cut my lawn, I'm not immoral, I'm not evil, I'm just, you know, not very productive, right? So if we're going to do things for pragmatic reasons, then we're going to do things for pragmatic reasons. Then questions of morality and right and wrong and virtue and evil and good and bad, they don't come into it at all because we're just about getting things done. But I believe that we want to do things, particularly in the questions of institutionalized violence and organization of conflict resolution within society, those are all fundamental moral questions. How do we live in a virtuous, free, noble, peaceful society? How do we eliminate war? How do we eliminate imprisonment? How do we eliminate torture? These are all essential moral questions. When you're going to go from the realm of pragmatism into the realm of morality, you can't erase your principles, because the whole reason you're there is because of the principles. Mr. Badnarik and I and Minarchist and I will agree self-owned property rights, the non-initiation of force, are the moral principles that are the most sacred, the most important, the most vital. I would argue the most pragmatic principles to hold to. We can't have a moral goal called the improvement of mankind, the reduction of violence and torture, war and murder, and then say, and our very first step towards that, we're going to break those moral principles and create an institution that has the right to do everything that we consider immoral. If we want to build a bridge towards virtue, we have to go in that direction. We don't say, it's so important, it's so moral to go north, the first thing I'm going to do is head south. You can't break the principle in your very first step. Maybe towards the end when things are really hellish, but not at the very beginning. And if you want a peaceful society, as we all do, and you want a society that respects persons, property, then you stick to those principles and you don't break them the very first time you set forward your solution and say, yes, property rights are important, so let's create an institution with the perfect power to destroy them. Yes, self-ownership is so important, so let's create an organization with the power to own people through taxation, through laws. yes, the non-initiation of force is the most important principle, so let's immediately create an institution which its very definition is to break that principle. Let's not sell out the first step. Okay, maybe the 100th step when we're offered a lot of money, but not the first step. And that's the consistency that voluntarism or anarchism or a dedication to nonviolence and to self-ownership gives you. You stick with your principles. If you're going to abandon your principles, why even bother being in the moral arena to begin with? And so let's not look to a violent institution to solve the problems of violence. Let's not look to a monopoly of the initiation of aggression to solve the problems of human conflict. Let's not give up on our principles the very first time we utter our solution, but let's stick consistently with those principles, because not only are they true, and not only are they moral, but damn it, they work. And this debate, which is completely nonviolent, and this audience, who is perfectly delightful, is a perfect example of that. Everywhere you look, you see spontaneous social organization without violence. You see it in the marriage market. You see it in the job market. You see it in the educational market. You see human beings coming together to solve problems in a voluntary and peaceful manner. Anarchy is what we live. Statism is the exception. People say, well, what's the proof of anarchy? They say, oh, can you prove to me that anarchy works? Look in the mirror. When was the last time you used violence to get a job? I have never used violence to get a job. Postal workers accepted. When was the last time you used violence to get a date? I've never used violence to get a date. So, you negotiate. You work peacefully. Does that mean everyone's like that? No, of course not. But that's why we can't have a government. People think it's an argument for the government. It's the exact argument against the government. We work voluntaristically, peacefully in every aspect of our lives. If you want to look at anarchism, look at 99.999% of everything that you do is voluntary and peaceful and cooperative. Yeah, you'll get disagreements. Yeah, you may raise your voice. Yeah, you may get mad at people. But you don't pull out guns and shoot people. That's the vast majority of people. And I'm not going to give up my freedom because there are a few evil people in the world. I'm not going to allow the fear-mongering of people who say you need a government but to protect you from the evil people. I don't want to give up my freedom, my daughter's freedom, my wife's freedom. I don't want to give up that freedom because there are bad people in the world. Isn't that surrendering something essential and important? Because there are bad people in the world, I need to get into a cage called statism. Doesn't that mean they win? That's a shame. I don't want that. I don't think you want that either. We have to come up with more creative solutions than, I hear something in the bushes, let me get into a cage for the rest of my life. I'm not that scared of bad people. I'm really not, to the point where I'm going to huddle in a cage, you know, like a frightened chihuahua, because there might be a beast out there in the bushes. Because every time I go out, I don't see a beast. And I see that the people who are telling me there's a beast are the ones who are the actual predators, right? Say, well, you got to get into the cage because the government is so, because there are predators out there, but the only guns I see are the government's. They're not protecting me from someone else. They are the people who are threatening me. I will take my chances that what's in the bushes is a squirrel rather than hide in a cage because I'm afraid of bad people. I don't want to surrender my liberty to the mere potentiality of evil. And I don't think you should either.
Capitalism usually gets a bad rap. We look at the economy, we've had a $1 trillion bailout, now we've got a multi-$1 trillion stimulus package being planned, you know, we got like a $1 trillion budget planned for next year, as if anything with, you know, 12 zeros left of the decimal point can accurately be called a budget. And they go, see, capitalism doesn't work. Well, we don't have capitalism in the United States. Not really. You know, we have an economy that is almost universally controlled by the government. You know, we just used that interstate commerce clause and the general welfare clause, and you know we have a population that doesn't understand the Constitution, and they can pretty much get anything by it. You know, it's like we've got a president who's handsome and articulate and promises change, and people are standing ovations, applause, and and you wonder why we're having problems. When I give my presentations, I will ask for a show of hands, how many people are good patriotic Americans? Not surprisingly, it's unanimous. Everybody's a good patriotic American. Okay, show of hands, how many people know how many articles are in the Constitution? Rarely. Rarely does anybody have any clue. And then my question is, what constitutes a good patriotic American? You know how to dress yourself in the morning? That's the criteria. You know, you got your shirt buttoned correctly, so that makes you a good patriotic American. I think the standard needs to be a lot higher than that. You know, we have a lot of criticism about the Constitution. Constitution doesn't work. Well, no, not if you don't use it. Most people have no idea what the Constitution says, so they wouldn't recognize unconstitutional government when it falls on them, not if. Most of what my government does is unconstitutional. I find that unconscionable and totally unacceptable. And with the last breath I ever take, I am going to do my best to restore a constitutional republic, to protect your individual rights, to protect your private property, and to limit the abuse that government has monopolized on us. It may not be the perfect answer, but we have government because a wide, vast majority of people really don't want anarchy. I've already discussed one topic, is the just abhorrence of violence. You know, it's like, I don't want to hurt anybody. In fact, a lot of people that I know, they don't even like verbal confrontation. I mean, I enjoy talking with Stefan and getting into all this. I mean, my favorite thing is these philosophical debates. I love it. You know, arguing back and forth, examining the ideas. A lot of people that I know don't even like to do that. It's like, you're raising your voice. Can't handle confrontation. I want everybody to just hug and love each other. Well, you can want it, but not likely going to happen, not universally. So, most of you will not accept anarchy because it's going to require you in some circumstances to perform violence. And most of you are not willing to pull the trigger to kill somebody that's trying to kill you. The other thing is that we do, as Stefan said earlier, we like property and we like the easiest way to accumulate it. And instead of working for it, if I can take yours, well, that's just a whole lot better. I let you go out and work in the field and grow all the corn, and I just show up at the end and, walk away with a wagon. Most people do not understand the difference between rights and privileges, and it boils down to you can do anything you want with your property. You can do nothing at all, justifiably, with my property. It's my property. I was speaking to a college audience, and one young lady raised her hand. I was a presidential candidate. She wanted to know what I was going to do about Medicare and Medicaid. And I said, they're theft. They're gone. And she was, horrified. Apparently I didn't understand the situation. She had to let me know that her mother was elderly and ill and had all of these medications that she needed to buy. And I said, well, do you love your mother? Well, yes, of course. Would you help your mother buy her medications? And she doesn't say yes or no. She immediately tries to divert the question. She goes, but what about that SOB up on the hill? The guy with the big motorhome in the driveway with more money than he knows what to do with. And the first thing I did was question her, how do you know that he has more money than he knows what to do with? Apparently he knows exactly what to do with his money. That's why he's got the motorhome in the driveway. But ultimately I said, okay, your mother needs these prescription drugs, which we all acknowledge are expensive. Are you going to take a gun and go up there and take that person's money? No, going to do that. Why not? Well, because that would be theft. And I said, oh, I get it. You want me to go up there and take that person's money and give it to you for your mother's prescription so you don't have to risk lead poisoning. You want the booty, but you don't want to take the risk. You want other people's property, and you want the government to do it for you. I am opposed to theft of any kind. I am opposed to individual theft, and I'm opposed to government-sponsored theft. We have individual rights. It's all based on private property. And I think that liberty does have a chance because the idea, the basic idea is private property, and even a two-year-old understands the importance of private property. What's a two-year-old's favorite word? Mine. Mine. I want it to be mine so I can be in control. Well, two-year-old doesn't understand the concept of yours, and we've got to convince them that, no, you're not allowed to play with Tommy's toys unless you get permission. Our government is currently acting like a two-year-old. They want to take your property and go, mine. We call it eminent domain. You know, in Texas, we had the Trans-Texas Corridor. Texas government was planning to steal 584,000 acres of private land to build some monstrosity highway. Now, I'm not a, you know, Luddite. I don't want to, like, you know, keep really low on technology. I travel in a really fast car. I like highways. I want them to be smooth and straight. But I don't want to have the government steal property and then allow a Spanish company to monopolize the profit from that. No, that's not going to happen. Not in Texas. So, anarchy, I believe anarchy is a wonderful ideal. Kind of like, you know, absolute, you know, 100% alcohol. Unfortunately, the laws of physics don't allow you to have 100% alcohol, and I think that human nature prevents us from getting to anarchy. You know, one, you don't want it because it puts too much responsibility on your plate, and two, because there's always somebody, sadly, who thinks they know how to run your life better than you do. And so I don't think that we can avoid government. You know, you can't make an omelet without breaking a couple eggs. I don't think that you can have a civil society without somebody kind of putting down some formal rules. And we just have to make sure that those rules do not subjugate one part of the population for another. Again, there are no easy answers, but that's our challenge. That is our challenge, to be intelligent enough, to be moral enough, to find and, you know, identify what the ideal, what the perfection would be, and move in that direction as often as we can. And maybe we'll get to it. Maybe we will achieve anarchy someday. But at the moment, I don't think even anybody knows which direction anarchy is. You know, you've never memorized the Bill of Rights. You don't know how many articles are in the Constitution. And so I'm doing my part to educate the population, you know, tell them, teach them the difference between rights and privileges, and hopefully, and I believe it is true, I believe that people are waking up, and I believe that people are more and more prepared to take responsibility for their own life because, well, frankly, the government has screwed it up so bad, you know, nobody likes the style of government we currently have. And so I want to thank Stefan, I want to thank Drexel University, and I want to thank the audience again for being so patient and being so intelligent to be here and listen to us discuss this high-level intellectual concept. Thank you very much.